Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this event, Digital Cities for Humans or for Profit, hosted by the Department for Media and Communications and LSE Cities. My name is Ben Rogers. I'm a Distinguished Policy Fellow at LSE Cities, and I'm really thrilled to be hosting or chairing tonight's event to celebrate Maria George's important new book. I think all of you will know who Maria is. She's Professor of Media and Communications at the Department for Media and Communications at LSE, and her work focuses on media and the city. And tonight we are publishing her new book, Being Human in Digital Cities, published by Polity. You would have seen it on your way in. There's been opportunity to buy the book and no doubt have it signed by the author after our discussion. I know how long Maria has taken to write this book, but I'm an author as well. I know we keep these grubby sort of secrets to ourselves. But suffice it to say, it's, I think, a really important and ambitious work that draws together, also develops questions that have been long at the center of Maria's work, questions around the way that digital technologies and media are reshaping human relations and cultures and their role in sustaining, deepening, and challenging inequalities. More particularly, this book asks us, you know, can we imagine alternative, more human digital urban futures? What traditions, thinkers, ideas, practices can help us imagine this more human future? And how in particular can researchers, academics, activists, and city governments help realize genuinely human cities? So those are the topics we're going to be discussing tonight. We're joined by a fantastically cosmopolitan set of experts and respondents, campaigners, researchers. Sara Al-Sharif is a human rights defender and researcher in digital rights. She tells me she just began a doctorate, but she's already leading the human rights group campaign Migrant Digital Justice. She launched a podcast back in 2021 in Arabic called Talknology, addressing issues of technology and people's rights. She's been involved in several studies of code bias, machine learning, and recognition technology and their human rights implications. So extremely qualified to talk about tonight's discussion. For some reason, I've got a much shorter entry to Ayana Nadata, but she's extremely distinguished. That's because she's got such a long track record, I've had to boil it down. But she's Professor of Human Geography at UCL, and her research interests are in urbanism, smart cities, gender citizenship, and regional futures, with a particular focus on the Global South. And lastly, and I'm just doing this in alphabetical order, Matt Mahmoudi, who's a lecturer, researcher, and organizer. He's been leading the Ban the Scan campaign for Amnesty International. He was the inaugural Joe Cox scholar at the University of Cambridge, studying digital urban infrastructures as new frontiers for racial capitalism. And he remains an affiliate there, lecturer in sociology. So we've got four experts who are both, you know, researchers, thinkers, and also, I think I'm going to say sort of activists, and working at that intersection of, I guess, sort of reform, change, and research. The way this evening is going to work is we are going to hear from Maria, who's going to give a 15-minute presentation on her book and its main themes and conclusions. We're then going to hear from our other three panelists, and they're just going to speak for sort of 8 minutes. We'll then have a panel discussion, but we'll leave plenty of time for questions from the audience, and there's going to be opportunities for our online audience to ask questions as well. I'm not quite sure how that's going to work, but I'm sure we're going to figure it out. We're on Twitter. I was interested to see that all of our panelists, who are sort of experts in in the media and inequality, are still on Twitter. Maybe that's something to be talk about as part of this discussion. Our hashtag is LSE Media, and we're at LSE Cities and at Media LSE Cities are our handles. So I think without further ado, unless I've missed anything, I think we'll just get on with tonight's discussion. Maria, over to you.
Okay. Can everyone hear me? Okay, so thank you everyone for being here. It's lovely to see so many of you. Lots of familiar faces, other people who do the honors to us to join us tonight. And thank you, of course, to the wonderful panel and what a great company to have this conversation. So with all these thanks, I should move to say something about my book, which is, I guess, what I have been asked to do tonight. So when I started thinking what should go on the cover of my new book, I did what so many of us do. I turned to Google's wisdom for inspiration. So I typed digital city on Google, and this is what I got back. I got lots of sleek, neat, and very blue, interestingly, images of incredibly connected cities. But as a rule, as we can see, these cities are all without people. The invisibility of humans is not only seen in this mainstream and possibly AI-generated imagery, though. We see it in many different imaginaries, very often also in research imaginaries. It is this kind of observations that generated my curiosity and the question driving this book. What if we start from the human, always in quotations, what if we start from the human, not technology, when we try to understand the significance of digital cities, their significance for society, economy, for life itself? And what if more specifically we think of the human in plural, urban humans in their diverse and unequal plurality across but also within cities? Seeking to see not only those occupying the city's glass skyscrapers, those having the latest iPhone, or those even who have access to this room, but also those occupying the urban and the transurban margins. We know that digital cities look very different from a penthouse and from a council estate, and choosing to remember or forget this shapes the very different stories we tell. When I started researching this book, I realized I was not alone in this quest to see humans in digital cities. But to my surprise, I found myself in strange company. Big tech, mainstream media, institutional actors, all speaking about and on behalf of urban humanity. Let me explain what I mean. So when I started doing this research, I came across data or quotes or voices like that. Delete technology, add humans, we read in the headline of a Forbes story. The Business Magazine article talks about cities, but not any kind of cities. After the smart city's death, we read, digital city is the new normal. Why? We continue reading, because digital cities, unlike so-called smart cities, are apparently, quote, built with a focus on the citizen, small business, enterprise, and consumers. Everyone wins. This kind of human centrism, I soon realize, is all but a glitch in corporate policy and media discourse of technologized cities. A headline that you also see up there in The Guardian about the day after the failed Google planned smart city of waterfront Toronto reads, Toronto swaps Google-backed, not-so-smart plans for people-centered vision. And the conservative The Telegraph confirmed my hypothesis about this new digital human centrism when it joined the chorus with a headline on digital cities. Of the people, for the people, by the people. The examples I came across are endless. The media, big tech, and policymakers tell us that we need to put our money, our faith, our consent in furthering technologization of cities. From urban sanitation and security to democratic and sustainable conduct. We should do so, we are told repeatedly, not because we believe in technocentric futures, but because actually we believe in humane futures. The dominant discourse of the digital city, I repeatedly saw, is tied to a promise of rehumanizing cities against the dehumanizing conditions of pollution, division, and crime in cities. Digital cities are no longer imagined and planned as technocentric and importantly as market-oriented projects, but instead as ethical projects that advance or should advance progressive, equitable, and sustainable futures. Of course, speaking on behalf of humanity is not unknown in hegemonic discourses of change. Throughout long and ongoing histories of colonialism and capitalism, decisions for resources extraction and their uneven distribution have often been justified as being named in the name of humanity. We also know, of course, how speaking on behalf of humans in this context has in the past, as it does at present, continued justifying the divide between a worthy and unworthy humanity, between those lives and freedom that are deserved and not deserving. But there's also something new in this hegemonic human centrism of digital cities. How the digital order that promotes urban futures of surveillance, predictive policing, privatization of public space, and automated assorting of rightful from unrightful claims to resources becomes opaque. And it becomes opaque precisely because all change happens in the name of humanist, progressive values, what I refer to as popular humanism. Popular humanism is seductive because it promises that technologies can humanize the dehumanizing city, yet it is dangerous because it incorporates progressive humanistic values to actually secure the existing and deeply unequal urban order. Because this order is embedded and dependent on technologies of the ordinary, smartphones, transport infrastructures, the network that connect us so that we can have fun, work, and find love, they're all mobilized effectively to reproduce this opacity of a digital order. But the space of the ordinary, we also know, everyday life is also messy. Everyday life is a space of order and control, but of course it's also a space of negotiation and exploration of what it means to be and become human in the city. This is what I call demotic humanism, the performative space of experimentation, of consumption, sometimes of survival, often played out in the contradictory everyday uses of the digital, from TikTok performances of urban identity to hashtag activism. In my research across cities, the sightings of demotic humanism are endless. In East Los Angeles, for example, I saw and I heard from locals how they use WhatsApp messaging to alert each other against ICE immigration raids. They turned to a very simple everyday technology to actually contest the border police sophisticated surveillance infrastructures. In Havana, I witnessed urban poor challenging communicative injustice by claiming their share of powerful Wi-Fi, a privilege that is usually safeguarded and enjoyed by the luxury hotel owners. Standing by the four-star hotel gate and with smartphones at hand, many Habaneros turned the privatized space of connection into an agora of digital publicness. But also across European cities, I saw how the par excellence technology of the urban ordinary, the smartphone, worked as a monitoring device. Many migrants are very well aware that their smartphones are much more than communication tools. At any time, authorities can use them to control their lives, as in many European countries, police has the power to demand from migrants at any point, at any place, to share all their phone data. For so many of them, freedom to move and to speak is always conditional, as the monitoring technologies of the border are always on. It was precisely those contradictory observations of urban humanity's presence, recognition and misrecognition across digital cities that puzzled me. if digital cities have become human-centric projects, what has and what can come out of this? As we briefly saw, popular humanism effectively normalizes an order that hides the violence of structural inequalities and surveillance life by promoting technologically induced democracy and sustainability. Demotic humanism reminds us that humanist values are not just the subject of an intellectual conversation. They are manifested in everyday claims for dignity and for freedom, often made through the same technologies that also deny those same rights. Popular humanism does little to liberate people, and demotic humanism holds a promise, but it's often caught in its ambivalence. Our surveilled and unequal futures, the inevitable fate of urban humanity, I ask in the book. Angela Davis, a brave and powerful voice of justice, reminds us that change needs hope. And this is where I want to turn to in concluding, to the hope that critical humanism opens up. The argument that I set forward in this book is that we need another humanism, a critical humanism, a humanism that is a force for transformative justice, not just a narrative of justice. The hope that critical humanism I set forward is not an abstract vision for a distant future. It is actually an empirically grounded and theoretically informed normative proposal that works at the same time as urban praxis, but also as an epistemology. We can observe the critical humanist urban praxis in different ways, and I came across quite a few. So we can observe its urban praxis, for example, in grassroots public performances and voices that momentarily unsettle platforms' commodified spaces. For example, when we see grassroots groups producing podcasts that tell stories of migrant and urban resistance to the hostile environment. We see this urban praxis in political protests that persist on defying the punitive logic of surveillance on the digital and material street. And we see it in campaigns for state and corporate accountability against cities governed through predictive policing and surveilled street life. And I know that some of our other speakers will address those issues. Critical humanism is also an epistemology that resists anti-humanism, anti-humanist and post-humanist arguments that the human is dead. If we're interested in transformative justice, we cannot give up on the human, in quotations mark, as an anchoring, though always diverse, non-essentialist and essential, a non-essential category. As Ruha Benjamin writes, posthumanist visions assume that we have all had the chance to be human. The humanism I propose learns from the knowledge, but also the imagination of radical black decolonial feminist and LGBTQI humanists in plural, and their denial to give up on freedom. And importantly, it learns from research participants' own experiences and storytelling of the city. Seeing and learning from how they explore being and becoming human, and how they do so with others, humans and non-humans, often under conditions of limited possibility. I hope that I myself have learned something about humanism through my own research, my research in multicultural neighborhoods, my research in urban refugee camps. In everyday acts of solidarity between neighbors, from sharing meals to sharing Wi-Fi, I witnessed what Mlabi refers to as ethics of compassion, equity, relationality. What I'm saying in this book, ultimately, is that we need to reclaim the human. This is not a claim to recognizing a singular conception of humanity, but a call to expand our intellectual and ethical imagination. And this is an imagination, I argue, in concluding, that understands digital infrastructures neither as a problem nor as a solution, that critiques capitalist greed and colonial extractivism that breeds the destructive Anthropocene. And it's an imagination that opens up a conversation about the ways we can conceive and work towards just and democratic urban presence and futures. Thank you.
Wonderful, and on time as well. That's absolutely brilliant. So there we have it, the sort of popular humanism of the big tech companies and their promoters, the sort of demotic humanism, I guess, which is more sort of technical. It's what we use in everyday, you know, to realize our sort of human values in our life. And then there's a sort of much more radical, transcendent or transformatory critical humanism. That's how I understand it anyway. Matt, do you want to respond? I don't know whether you want to sort of sit down or go up to the podium. You're happy to do either. And do feel free to say a bit more about yourself as well as you.
Thank you. No, I feel the podium is reserved for the editor-in-chief here. Oh, wow, I'm destroying the room already. I apologize. Thank you so much for having me, Maria. It is a real honor to be here and to see so many of your faces. Thanks for coming. Really, I think Maria is getting to the crux of really a critical discussion that we've been having also in the space of the NGO world, in which we're dealing more with advocacy and policy around these issues and kind of what kinds of rights violations they bring to the fore. And in my sort of response to the book, I'm going to be straddling both NGO activist lens whilst also bringing that together with my sort of activist scholar hat. And it's going to be taking on and off hats sort of every minute or so. But please bear with me as I try to bring this together. So over the last decades, as a lot of Maria's research has shown, cities have been the site of a battle for technospatial real estate, really, in everything from the Internet of Things, connecting everyday infrastructures to cloud-controlled processes, including transit, entry, connected sensors, AI-driven surveillance, and early warning systems. The process of generating digital twins, which some of you might have heard of cities, through digitalization, further datification and atomization of city life and processes, as well as, you know, some of the more sort of fatty hype words like blockchain, in particular blockchain-based identity and e-citizen services, purporting to generate greater transparency control among citizens. So the strive for the smart city, as it were, has given governments the ability to erect a mirage of control and order through technology deployments, while allowing technology corporations to become an essential part of the performance and governance in cities, oftentimes without being openly acknowledged as such. And that's really where I take my entry point, is thinking about, you know, how do we think about critical humanism in a context in which so much of our space to do so is being co-opted in ways that aren't obvious at all times. At its extremes, we've seen how cities have been weaponized for speculative and at times pseudoscientific experimentation with remote biometric recognition tools such as race and gender and emotion recognition, exacerbating processes by which minority communities are further targeted, surveilled, and persecuted, as we've seen through the use of the sense time system in Hangzhou, in Sanmenxia, and Wenzhou in China. Alternatively, there are contexts under which the freedom of society is threatened at large owing to repression, arbitrary and mass surveillance, and the shrinking of civic space, cities being built sort of with unprecedented data harvesting at their core, cities like Saudi Arabia's NEOM project. Our research at Amnesty Tech has also shown how the dangers of the emergence of the surveillance smart city, such as places like Hyderabad City in India and New York City in the United States, where city dwellers living in areas at greater risk of being stopped and frisked by law enforcement, sort of an analog stop and frisk, and in areas with higher proportions of non-white residents are also more likely to be exposed to facial recognition technologies. So if you happen to be a black or brown person living in an area that's already hyper-policed, it stands to reason that you're also most exposed to facial recognition systems. So even if those systems are trained with, say, you know, non-white faces, it doesn't matter, because even if they are not biased within its programming and the machine learning algorithm, the way in which it's deployed follows racial lines in urban space. In Hebron, we see how the technology is used to reinforce arbitrary restrictions on the freedom of movement, barring Palestinians from being able to access their basic rights, affecting their abilities to access work, education, medical care, and family life, right? So there are really numerous ways in which sort of city optimizing processes are being used to actually restrain and restrict and constrain our freedoms. In cities like these, the entanglements of digital urban infrastructures with corporate power have been increasingly commonplace. Back in New York City, for example, I've been looking at how the mayor's
office appointed tech giants from Meta, formerly Facebook, Alphabet, IBM, Microsoft, and Verizon to its NYCX advisory board and several other elite city committees. This team up of tech giants, for example, served to ensure that New York City achieved its mission of becoming, and I quote, a testbed for new technologies, transforming the relationship between city government, community, and the tech industry. And this is a direct quote from Bill de Blasio from back in 2018. Now, cities have become a space where data pipelines are constructed, cultivated, expanded, and fed. More than ever, as researchers, advocates, and campaigners, our attention has to be turned to how our rights are being hollowed out from under our feet in the very cities we live in service of the smart fetishistic futures and fantasies of Silicon Valley giants that Maria really talks about here. Imagine, for instance, how the processes of navigating the city via augmented reality might be tailored to you and what the city knows about you in particular. What might you be barred from accessing? How might you be rerouted and subject to your wealth, race, immigration status, and criminal record? These global developments are especially worrying given the situatedness of cities as sanctuaries, historically providing the scale and numbers for example, persecuted communities to hide under the anonymity of the sheer vastness of urban environments. And this is actually how I came to know Miria on a personal capacity, because my research started to think about, you know, how are digital urban infrastructures challenging the possibility of sanctuary? And you were already asking these questions in Berlin. They also have implications for the contemporary and future distribution of power within cities, right? So between the privileged and those of them on the margins of it. So the groundwork has already been laid for the emergence of a mobile outcast ghetto, as is referred to by Shapiro, in which underprivileged and historically marginalized communities are increasingly ending up. Here, logistics orchestrates the control and management of surplus populations, keeping them in their social and economic place, even as they move about the city, Shapiro says. By way of an example, and I quote again, the bad part of town will be full of algorithms that shuffle you straight from high school detention into the prison system. The rich part of town will get mirror glass limos that breeze through the smart red lights to seamlessly deliver the aristocracy from curb into penthouse. In such future city, our machine legibility and conformity becomes a huge part in our ability to access basic rights and services. You may find out that your daughter cannot get her subsidized medication owing to what one could speculate might be thought of as data debt, the decision not to share certain data with a party whose advertising profit made at your expense in part funds medical care. Your human dignity and access to rights, in other words, at the whim of your contribution to capitalism. It's not inconceivable that in these future cities, our rights depend on aggressively data and biodata intensive human-computer interaction, biometric interfaces that require reading vital signs and other health indicators constantly and passively, with insurance costs of those with the poorest health or those with most strenuous working conditions rising in line with such metrics. Fitness trackers and smartwatches have already laid the groundwork for this, with facial recognition-enabled smartwatches even being proposed as a form of incarceration for migrants with criminal records in the United Kingdom back in 2022. In such scenarios, we're penalized from opting out of our cyborg futures. Those of us unwilling to make ourselves known must be prepared to live in conditions of permanent turnstile jumping, and I mean that metaphorically and possibly literally. These developments, especially in cities where the pervasiveness of cashless transaction is a de facto expansion of digital urban infrastructures that control how we engage with goods and services, and indeed who can engage with these, may also lead to a ban on cash, eroding informal markets and safe spaces for those living in fear of surveillance, persecution, and expulsion. In a particularly dire speculative scenario, thought crimes detected through a mixture of responses to high-frequency advertising techniques or attention trading, as Chaudhary refers to it, and biometric markers based on debunked ideas around microexpression and phrenology may lead to preemptive arrest, detention, or expulsion, flattening society to an ideologically homogeneous whole. Finally, while these cities also boast both a narrative of greater efficiency and the potential of artificial intelligence to surmount climate degradation and ecological collapse, they depend in no small part on the mobilization of vast amounts of energy to power expanding computational processing needs. These cities bear the brunt of the responsibility for the adverse climate impacts felt in areas where the so-called externalities of the smart city are exported, such as countries and areas that have become dumping sites for e-waste and other exhaust materials from our so-called innovative means of surmounting climate challenges. while, and I'll end with this, in my own work, I've been looking at how digital cities become sites of extraction of techno-racial capital for tech companies who rely on the existence of racialized bodies, right? At once playing the part of the victim in need of tech to alleviate their conditions, whilst also playing the part of the threat that must be neutralized. And this is always a precondition, right, upon which these programs and technologies are often developed. They service the technology companies, they service the security needs of local authorities whilst also providing integration tools for newcomer asylee communities, all the while making them more machine legible, detectable, detainable, deportable. And so we see how structural inequalities that are often hidden under digitalization efforts, even at times co-opted as a problem justifying the deployment of the particular technology, they endure. Ultimately, digital urban infrastructures work antithetically to their purported objectives while reliant on an emancipatory framing, a sort of a popular humanism, such as the myth of extending access. But to what? Connectivity, on whose terms, and welfare, at what cost? It's now more prudent than ever to reorient ourselves towards this critical humanism that reclaims and rebuilds cities with justice and fairness at their core, where interventions that extend and improve the rights of at-risk communities are fundamentally tech agnostic and work in service of residents, not corporations. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Just before I turn to Sarah, I mean, so you've offered a sort of very, very sort of dystopian interpretation of popular humanism. But Marie, am I right that for you, I mean, you see the sort of turn towards popular humanism away from the smart city as a sort of somewhat positive thing? I mean, you're not completely dismissive of it, are you?
Well, I'm not sure if this is on. Okay, it is on. I'm suspicious of popular humanism, but I think it's a sign of something positive, that there is a sense that there's a deep systemic crisis and a mistrust to the system and the big tech. Thus, this incorporation of humanistic values by powerful actors, I think it's a response to this kind of crisis. So, yes, not necessarily optimistic for popular humanism itself, but perhaps on what this incorporation of humanism by powerful actors perhaps reflects.
Right. I mean, they have to be somewhat constrained by their sort of by their rhetoric and their discourse, I suppose. Mm. So, over to you. Would you like to respond? To the presentation, to the book.
Yeah, it's working. I'd like to start from where Myra started, like when she searched about like the digital cities. Like, I think this is all what we imagined, like when we talk about digital cities or smart cities, it's a blue, everything is digital, electronic. Maybe we imagined like we will find like offline cars or robots in the street, but it's literally the digital cities or smart cities or where we live now, where is like a CCTV everywhere, facial recognition, scanning our faces. There is a rate over our credit cards, wherever we are using our credit cards, our mobiles, our location. It's rating us and categorizing us to something. And while we are having this, like it's digital cities, it's like in the heart of the digital city or smart cities is like how they promote it is like for human, which is, it's not about humans. It's about our data. It's about our information. It's about like the profit, which is like, it's about control in the heart of it, which is not a new ideas. It's started from a long, old history, started with the forest when they find the forest and the king finds the forest could be a source for money. So there was a need to categorizing the forest and trim the forest and to put it in shapes. This is what's happening to us now. We should fit into a categories. We should fit into shapes. We should be assigned to numbers or to categories to, for them to know and to take decisions. And the most risky and dangerous thing, like decisions now will not be made by human. It will be made by the machine, by automated machine. And what I loved about Myra's books too, like when she mentioned digital cities, she didn't mention digital cities in Saudi Arabia only now it's like London and New York and Los Angeles, because it used to say like digital cities and control, which happening in authoritarian countries. No, it's happening here now in our cities and in our land, collecting our information, collecting our data to control us. And it's starting always with most minorities and migrants, and they starting with collecting their data and using them as guinea pigs for this technology first, and collecting their data. And this we could, and like shaping, like to shape our behavior, to shape our history, to shape our how we react, how we engage. So if we imagined, like if we are migrant or minorities live in the UK, and our data collected according to the law and the regulation here, not everyone has the same kind of protection of their privacy. Migrants and refugee is less protected for their information. So they started by categorizing their data and collecting their data, and to analyzing this, to decided how to get visa, how to revoke your visa, how to get job, and who didn't get jobs, and using their data to to make some research and related categorizing the cities like in London with racially, and using like in assigning these cities to like whether it's like it's a healthy cities, and relating connecting the diseases with the reality, so it's affect like people like or companies who provide high insurance for people living in this area according to a result of connecting their data to the possibility of having certain disease or spreading in this area. I think we saw this clearly during the COVID 19, while we are having like it was risk always like to discriminate against certain cities or certain places because the high rates of the COVID-19 in these cities, and how it affect like their insurance company, their opportunities for work, and how it affect like how the company will use this data to target these places with job ads. For example, they might not target these places for job ads for the high risk of getting COVID or getting certain diseases. So it's always about who owns the technology, and the problem now, like it's not even the government who owns technology, it's the big tech and the people who already design this kind of technology, and the people behind the money who funded this kind of technology, and in which way they want to use this data to shape our behavior. So if the people of the agenda behind designing this data is like, as we see in Silicon Valley, is far right group, they will use our data according to their agenda to shape our behavior according to their agenda. So yeah, this is Berlin Rock.
Brilliant. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for inviting me, Marianne. I've got the book here. I was very glad to be part of this panel also, because I did read the book much earlier when I was writing the endorsement. So it's a pleasure to be here and talk about the book. I think what I've come across in your book was the key question around what does it mean to be human in the digital city. And you talk about three different ways of being human, the post the human as in the popular humanism, the human in the demotic humanism, and then finally, of course, the critical humanism. In my own work, I've been researching particularly from the grassroots earlier, and the smart cities and the humanism from below, digital cities from below. And more recently, I've been moving towards understanding the digitalizing state and digitalization as a process. And I know in your book, you also talk about liminality, and you talk about the citizen being liminal. And certainly the way I have always approached cities is the sort of always in transformation, always in transition, always changing. So I won't be able to talk about everything, but I think some of my work, which really draws upon your concept of critical humanism, or maybe also speaks to it, is are two projects that I completed recently. One is called Gendering the Smart City, and the other was called Digitizing the Periphery. And this was, of course, in India. And we looked at what I was conceptualizing at that time as the networked periphery, where the periphery of the urban is in a paradox. Excuse me. So, the paradox is that there is a proliferation of digital apps, software, digital technologies, infrastructures that go into the geographic periphery of the city. But at the same time, those people inhabiting that geographic periphery are completely in the margins, in the socio-political economic margins, but also maybe in the margins of access to digital technologies. And something interesting was happening there in this urban periphery that was overlaying with the digital periphery. And so we were thinking about this as networked. They're highly networked, and yet they're marginalized. And so from these two projects, we produced two types of toolkits. The first one was what we called a feminist digital toolkit. And the feminist digital toolkit was really about understanding how, in this case, women living in low-income neighborhoods, maybe slums or resettlement colonies in the periphery of the city, were using very frugal and low-cost technologies, perhaps just even a basic mobile phone, a basic feature mobile phone, in order to navigate the city and move in and out of the city physically, but also in and out of digital spaces. So we looked at the city as a contact zone, following Marie Louise Pratt's very classic work on the contact zone. We looked at the city as a contact zone between the home and the mobile phone and women's bodies. And the feminist digital toolkit was to really understand how there is a possibility for women to be present, either physically or digitally, in the city, okay, and to bear witness to what's happening to them. So the mobile phone, in this case, was a political and politicized object in the hands of women who are highly marginalized, but also younger women who are very well connected to digital spaces, in the ways that they use this very political object in negotiating the exclusions and inclusions between digital and material spaces. And so one of the purposes of that feminist digital toolkit was to produce authorship, which we call authorship as the ability to speak, write, curate, and direct the future of the city on one's own terms, based on one's experiences, struggles, and hardships, but also making this visible not necessarily always in physical spaces of the city, but also in the digital spaces of the city, and becoming therefore legitimate in the public domain, the digital and physical public domain. So storytelling one's own experiences through specific ways of being and belonging to the city. So that was one. And then the other one was the network periphery, where we looked at the actual urban periphery, which has become the proliferation of logistics companies. And this was in the peripheries of Mumbai, where despite it's very little access to any other kinds of infrastructure, there's a proliferation of digital infrastructure, which enables concentrated embeddedness of global logistics companies like Amazon, Flipkart, Walmart, etc. And it's an extractive proliferation in which both environmental resources like water or agricultural land is extracted in to service the global logistics, but also extractive labor, producing the gig economy. So it's always a paradox. And so from there, we also produced another toolkit, which was Pathways to Digital Democracy. And we talked about four pillars, one being the state, that the state, you know, there were guidelines about how the state can initiate democratic governance. The second was enabling more different forms of digital diversity, not just relegating this to CCTV and surveillance technologies, but also a diversity of technologies and infrastructures that would be more frugal and more rudimentary to enable all sorts of participation. And then the third one is very similar to, or relates much more to your book, the idea of participatory citizenship, and how citizens can author the future of their city, they can author their their participation, their visibility in their city. And then finally, another thing that we thought was really important, and that's something Matt talked about, is the regulatory, legal and regulatory spaces that would enable citizens not just to participate and access, but also have the right to information. And information is a battleground now. As you've already talked about, disinformation, malinformation, and all of that. And how, through that, do we enable forms of or rights to information that would produce critical consciousness, that would produce forms of empowerment that is not possible through the sustainable development goals, so to speak, of just inclusion and how many people have access to mobile phones. So I don't have too much time to talk about that, but I just wanted to end on this note around critical humanism, and maybe that's where I can contribute and add more flesh or a kind of act in solidarity with what you've said in your book. And maybe raise the question of whether we can actually truly think of being human now without the digital. So you're talking about being human in a digital city, but can we be human? Can we conceive about a human without the digital? And Mary, in your book, you mentioned two instances that being human is different from the cyborgian posthumanism that's more related to ANT or actor network theory. And I completely agree with that. But I do want to suggest that being a cyborg is not necessarily the kind of machinic, the science fiction Terminator type cyborg, because the cyborg doesn't necessarily have to be post-human. And here I'm drawing upon one of my favorite authors, Donna Haraway. Donna Haraway's cyborg, which recognizes the limits of technology and argues against this digital gluttony that we see in cities. Haraway critiques technology as what she calls a Gotrick of the digital era, and she suggests that technology has made ambiguous the differences between human-machine or natural or artificial, total or partial. So I'd suggest that perhaps thinking about the human in terms of how the human is changing, how our concept of being human is changing alongside the technological advances that we see today. That is, that the boundary is actually shifting rather than becoming post-human or post-machinic or post-anything for that matter. And so the increased transformation of our everyday lives, livelihoods, leisure and pleasure are all mediated to some extent by code, algorithms, computer screens, mobile phones, and even as very marginal subjects that might not even have access to digital technologies, we are still digital in the sense that the digital is always capturing our data. So cyborgs are not necessarily post-human, they are embodied fleshly beings that produce knowledges. And in my projects, I think about them as bearing witness from situated subjectivity, but also that they are temporal, that every moment in the city is a temporal moment, that things change in every moment. And cyborgs, cyborgian positionality, the positionality of being human is related to a kind of a situated temporality in that particular context. So I want to bring back Haraway in our discussion of humanism and propose that we need to think about it through a kind of feminist digital politics of post-reflexivity and sort of our positionality and temporality in this moment and how we're thinking about the human. And so following many scholars, I want to suggest that we've always been cyborgs since the dawn of technology, and therefore, is there another way of thinking about the human, not as antagonistic, but rather alongside the machine, that the human is not necessarily separate from the digital, but that the human and the digital are co-creating or co-constructing each other as we speak? And whether there are other ways to reconceptualize the digital towards a more decolonizing move that enables us to maybe refocus or re-enable and reimagine what is the purpose of the digital and even what is the purpose of a city, so to speak. And so the very terms of using the digital and how we think through what the digital will do to us and to the city will enable us to think about what we might then do to the digital in the future. I'll stop there.
Thank you. As I said earlier, we'll talk a bit amongst ourselves, and then we'll open it up to comments and questions. Maria, another question just for you. I mean, your book is called Being Human in Digital Cities, but why isn't it called Being Human in Digital Societies? I mean, what work is sort of cities doing here? Is it just the fact that more and more of us live in cities? You refer at one point to the sort of democratic promise of the city. I'm just, I'm wondering why cities? You don't really talk about that in the book.
Yes. And I think also, Iona, I'm sure she has something even much smarter to say. And she actually, you ended up your contribution by saying, why digital and why the city? There are many different ways, and I'm sure, you know, Iona probably will have a different way to answer this question. I will say something about how I came to the city, which I think is part of the answer. As some of the people here know, a lot of my work is on migration. And in many ways, I landed to the city through migration. And anyone who does research on migration knows that the cities are the spaces where most migrants are more likely to end up being, and the places that are many migrants are more likely to seek to find themselves. So migrants don't usually move into nations, they move to cities. And this for me became, from the beginning of that work, a very intriguing reality. And I know there are other people like Susie Hall, for example, who has done wonderful work on migrant cities. There's something about the cities about being spaces of thrown togetherness, as Doreen Massey says. Those spaces that would come close together, not by choice, but because our different trajectories bring us in this place, right? So I think, to me, being so interested in human and agency, I think the city produced this kind of possibility of thinking, how do we become human precisely when we find ourselves in these positions of thrown togetherness? So there's something about the city that is organic, that has to do, I think, with many of the ways that we live, or many of us live, especially through difference and through thrown togetherness. But of course, there is something about technology that is important about cities. And I think everybody has spoken, touched upon that, right? So cities are both the places where technologies are tested out, and technologies are and innovation is being sold most aggressively. Right, and the two then come together. The thrown togetherness of the city that creates social spaces of difference calls different actors to be much more interested in investing in technologies that organize, order, and of course surveil and assort the life in cities.
Okay, so I mean, I suppose I thought you might talk about, you know, the social imaginary of cities, the sort of citizenship, the networks, the sort of the public spaces, but that's there as well. That's not so important.
Yes, it is, and I think especially in the chapter on popular humanism, I talk a lot about the urban imaginary. In my other previous book on media cities, I talk even more about urban imaginaries. But for me, the city has become important, and of course there is huge gaps in my understanding of cities and conceptually, and I don't have. I learned studying the city on my own. It has always been something that is inviting as a bottom-up field of where people live and where many of the huge inequalities and tensions around how we live together emerge. So it's much more of a kind of bottom-up rather than a top-down.
Right. Do any of you want to reflect this? I mean, what role does the sort of imaginary of the city play in your work? Is this a sort of help? I mean, is this a helpful discourse, or do you, you know, is there something which is sort of richer and more?
Well, I mean, if I want to reflect on digital cities, I think there is a legal and a regulatory element that makes the city, and that comes from the state, planning and governance, because the city is also a legal entity. And that's where I think a lot of the focus has gone in creating this popular humanism of the smart city, because the smart city is an entity, whether it's legal, whether it's through these packages that the global IT firms are selling, it is sold to the city, because the city, as you said, is a critical mass of people, and where else do you get data other than this place where there is a critical mass of people? But yeah, there is also an imaginary of the city that exists, both of people who stay in the city and of people who don't stay in the city, but also connect to the city in some way or the other. And that's where I think the lines get more blurry, because those who stay in the city have specific struggles and they negotiate the city now often through digital means. And then those digital means connect them to the city through a network of other communication possibilities. But I think also the fact that the city is so networked and connected makes it possible for it to be exploded and connected to global sort of space with, let's say, logistics and its connections to other cities and other kind of translocal connections that it's possible to make with this city imaginaries. And therefore, acts of solidarity, affect, and all of that begin to emerge. So I certainly think the city has become something else now when we think about it as highly networked through communication systems, which was always there with telegram and telephones, etc. But now I think kind of the speed and scale of it has really exploded, and the city is becoming more and more of focus because of the critical mass of people. And it's probably easier to do because it is also a legal entity. But if we think about the city in bounded terms, I think there's also a danger in our research and scholarship, because the city certainly isn't that boundary. It extends way beyond, and scholars of sustainability will say that the city is extracting resources thousands and thousands of miles away, and yeah, e-waste and all of that connects the city to a much bigger hinterland across the world.
I do feel free to comment on what we've said so far, but it's a question for both of you too, because both of you offered us a sort of very pessimistic and terrifying account of the way that technology is being used to divide us, to repress us, to control us. I mean, but you talked about the importance of hope. Where do you see hope? I mean, where do you see the movements or the actors that are challenging this, if anywhere?
Yeah. I could say that the only hope that we could have, like, in controlling our death, it's like to see, like, to have the control over our death. And this is only what happened through the regulations and law. But what we are seeing now, like, the state and the government pushing into having the power, more power over people's death. We are seeing, like, now we have in the UK GDPR, while everyone have a right for privacy and automated decisions, not the final decisions, and you have the access, subject access request, you have the right to ask for your data, but there is a huge amount of pushing in the parliament now for data protection bill, which wiping people's rights for subject access requests, so you will not be allowed for organizations or the government will have more power to not tell you what data they have about you. Automated decisions will be the final decisions. So even now, with the GDPR, the automated decision can't make the final decisions about your visa, about your work, about whatever it happened to you, about your loan, about your credit card. But with the new bill in the parliament, the automated decisions will be the fate for everyone, and you will have no right to
appeal. You're active out there, you're campaigning against this. You must see some grounds for hope. Okay. Matt, do you see any hope?
I mean, I was recently in a talk with Rosalind and Gilmore, who reminded us to despair as counter-revolutionary, to trying to stay true to my sort of Marxist orientation. I'm going to try and be hopeful and not counter-revolutionary. So I guess the question mark emerges around sort of, where has the digital city left the urban commons and public property as is traditionally conceived? And I think because of the amount of corporate capture, and I say corporate capture in inverted commas, because really we've just discussed how it's a symbiotic relationship between the state, local authorities, tech companies. What is the state? What is local authorities anymore? Where does tech company end and city begin? It's unclear, right? But like the commons, given how much it's been encroached upon, going from sort of a more analog surveillance of Central Park to now like not really having a sense of whether you can even reclaim your neighborhoods outside of having the NYPD, for example, in New York, snooping in and seeing what you're up to and surrounding your neighborhood and having you, basically forcing you towards having to re-navigate
the city entirely. Like, how, what's the city look like to you and I will vary very differently. And I think what that has done, and this is where the hope comes in, what that has done is that it has developed a sense of our neighborhoods and our immediate locales are under threat. And these sort of phrases that have been thrown around to try and create good for us, whether it's the commons, whether it's the park, whether it's the, you know, sort of digital initiative that seeks to integrate migrant communities, whatever it is, that has now been fully sort of, I guess, exposed for its hypocrisy. And what that does is that it gives space for, and I have to excuse my language here, the fuck police, the fuck the police movement, whose entire purpose was to go around and destroy surveillance architecture, Rethink Link NYC, which is a collective of women that are fighting surveillance that's come about through domestic violence by putting stickers on cameras across urban cities, urban spaces. It's come around through a number of different sort of, like, I'd say neo-Luddite movements, you know, that are trying to reclaim the city and trying to rebuild what they think the city should be about. Less about the corporate tech utopianism, more about the sort of humanistic utopianism that's grounded in the locale and the community. And I do think that movement is on the rise, and that gives grounds for hope. Because if we can rearticulate the city from a space of resistance, then we can rearticulate cities globally, and one movement can learn from the other. And I do think that has revolutionary potential.
I'm very keen to hear from Maria and Iona about where they find hope. But I also know that you're probably waiting to get involved. So I'm going to take some questions from the floor. And how are we going to take questions from our online?
Yeah,
no, well, yeah, but then when it comes to our online. Yeah, and then you'll. Then you... Perfect. Right, we've got mics here. Put your hand up if you've got questions. I'll take short comments, but I do want them short. A woman with a white cardigan. I might take a couple of people at a time.
So thank you all so much for the very, very interesting insights. My question comment was sort of, obviously now there's been an increasing trend in how public spaces, community spaces are kind of being demolished, real estate is taking over. How do you think that this fares into this narrative of digitalization, and especially the impact that it might have on democracy and like civic participation? And going forward, how do you think sort of policymakers and stakeholders can try and rectify this, and focusing on communities and democratic engagement while we navigate this time? Thank you so much.
There was someone right in front. Someone right in front of you. Yes, there. Who? Yeah, he's got his hand up.
Thank you very much. And the criticisms that you were talking. You've been discussing a lot of rearticulating or changing the city, but I wonder if we should get rid of cities, if that wouldn't be much more like a proper revolutionary change.
Yeah.
Well, I should have asked you to identify. Who are you? Wait, do you want to say who you are or where you're from?
I'm from the Department of Media and Comms, Cesar Jimenez.
Right, okay.
Someone in the yellow sweater.
Okay, we'll take one more question. The man there with his hand up. And then I'll do one more round afterwards.
Hi, my name is Ben Hawes. I'm a tech policy consultant. A decade ago, I actually worked on smart cities policy for the government here when it was very, very briefly, I think. More recently, I worked with an ordnance survey and a media network on some international principles for responsible use of geospatial data. And my experience of that is data protection rights are individual and very limited and negative. And if we're in a situation where private companies won't act in the collective interest and individuals can't, who can? And I suppose that leads me to actually, what is the role of the local public sector, local public services, the only people who actually have duties to act locally in the collective interest?
Great. Let's you start first.
Okay, thank you. I'll try to be brief so that everybody has a say. Demolishing public spaces. Yes, I think this is one of the invisible ways through which the digital order works, right? So we have pseudo public spaces. We think they're public spaces, but they're full of cameras and controlled usually by private corporations. So yes, there's a lot of demolishing and threat to public spaces across cities. But I think I'll just go back to Matt's comment that there is also that counter movement. movements at the hyper-local level, where many communities are seeking to reclaim public spaces. Yeah. And then you have also the guerrilla or urbanism in different small spaces in the city where claims public space is being made. Get rid of cities? No, absolutely not, Cesar. Cities is where we come together, and I think I'm very optimistic. I think cities pollute, but cities also have the potential to be, I think, the most sustainable places. Most importantly, cities bring us together, and I think having no choice but to clash into each other's world is the way that we have to think and find ways to do that. And that's why cities were anti-Brexit in the UK, right? Cities tend to be much more progressive spaces. I'll leave the other points to others.
I'm glad to say, but I'm going to intervene here. I don't think that this campaign to sort of claim public space is just a local phenomenon. I mean, I think it's sort of global. I mean, I think we've seen huge movements. Black Lives Matter was about making public space safe. There's all sorts of campaigns to roll back the car. There's huge campaigns around resisting privatization of public space, you know, the Gezi Park protests in Istanbul. I mean, these are not just some sort of guerrilla, small guerrilla tactics going on in radical parts of cities. These are global phenomenon with often sort of quite profound geopolitical consequences.
Maybe I can say something different, given that I do a lot of my research in the Global South. Well, I mean, first of all, about the commons and the urban spaces, open spaces in the city, or, you know, accessing the city as a public. And this relates also to surveillance. I think there's often this thinking that there is too much surveillance in public spaces, and of course there is. But the kind of research I have been doing, particularly with women, the influx of smart city technologies that have gone into urban public spaces have been all about surveillance, particularly surveillance about women's bodies. Yet, some of the women, well, most of the women that I talk to from these low-income neighborhoods would rather be out in the city than be at home. So I think we also need to rethink what we mean by surveillance. Sometimes the home can be the most unsafe place. The home can be the most surveilled space, not digitally, but in many other ways. And for many of the women that I have spoken to in the Global South, for them being out in the city, it gives them a sense of freedom. And what they want, of course, is not more surveillance that extends the surveillance from the home to the city, but rather other ways to make informed consciousness that is training and information gathering and sharing about changing misogyny or changing practices in the city that keep them unsafe. So I think we also maybe need to expand our understanding of what surveillance is, surveillance, what surveillance does, and who does surveillance. So that's one. And the second one, going back to your question about being hopeful, I think I'm hopeful in the sense that all of the surveillance and all of these things that we are fearful of how the state and global corporates are monitoring us. Coming from the Global South, I think my hope is that the way I see the digitalizing state unfolding is so haphazard, so fragmented, and particularly the state has so little capacity. And my hope is that it's never as seamless as it presented to us. So what is performed to us as citizens is that everything is going to be ubiquitously surveilled and everything will connect to each other. And I'm sure that happens in New York, but it doesn't really happen in that connected way, this Internet of Things. It happens in kind of really patchwork ways, and then fitting the patchwork together never gives the seamless way of surveillance, which maybe isn't that hopeful, because then it leads to fragmented ways of ordering and digital reordering, and then it gives false positives. But also I think that what the state actually tells us in terms of how well it can do with the digital is really also a performance and a fiction and a myth. So maybe that's where I'm hopeful, that it will never be what they say it will be. And so, yeah, they will ask for Pegasus to come in and do a little bit of surveillance, but it will never be connected to everything else. And maybe that's how it is in the Global North as well. So that's where my hopefulness comes from.
Okay. uh, I, should we take some questions from online?
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Given that marginalised groups and minorities are exploited by digital cities, what are the ways, if so, in which the societal elite are threatened?
What are the ways?
What are the ways, if so, in which the societal elite are threatened?
Give us another one.
Yeah, another one. Are digital cities less resilient? The more that can go wrong, will go wrong.
Yeah, very abstract questions. Everyone's nodding. And one final one.
How ephemeral are digital cities and societies? Will data and knowledge longer on vellum, paper, or digital storage?
There's last two, at least, somewhat related. So that's about the sort of the longevity or the ephemerality of digital cities.
Perhaps Martin and Sarah can start with these.
Or anything else you've heard?
I'll talk about that our society is less resilient, and with, I think, like, and merge it with same questions about demolishing the public spaces or digital spaces. It's like the questions like how much we are free now, like how much our decisions that we are took, it's based on real desire, not about influence through algorithm or ads come to us, or because posted like showed to us, or because like we exposed to events, like how much we are free in taking these decisions. I think this is the main questions that we should think about, and like we should always burst the balloon of algorithms that around us. We should always go out of norms to test like how much we know really, like, because like we live in the same city as you see it said, but really we are isolated. Everyone sees something different. Everyone targeted by different algorithms according to what they like and what they might prefer to see, or what the tech companies or the capital want them to see. So it's like, yeah, despite like we are live in one cities, we so much isolated in our bubbles. So the problem here, or the hope here, is like to try to go out of norm. So if we keep like following certain people over social media, or from time to time, you have to expose yourself to something different, because what you see is designed to only to see that. It's like it's a design. It's not organic as it was before. Internet is not free. It's not free as it was before. And another questions regarding the cities, like, yeah, we could get rid of the cities. We could get rid of the design digital cities who made to profit from us, and looking for design cities like serve the humans. Like, it's like you will be surprised, like how cities, like if you are people experience of like architectures or design urbanism, like they design the cities now, it's like how it looks from above, how it looks for Google Earth to read the roads, how it will be easy for the police, the law enforcement to intervene to in protest, or to intervene in any kind of right or mass, how they could intervene in fast and possible way to control the people. So what we aim for is design cities serve humans. Cities serve humans and familiars for the human who already live in these cities, not for the tech companies and machine and government to control them.
Very good. Matt, you want to respond to anything you've heard so far?
Yeah, okay, so let's start. Did I understand one of the questions correctly from the online audience, that about what sort of threats this whole
these whole developments presented to elites? Was that a correct interpretation? Right, okay. So starting with, you know, what are the possibilities of upsetting elites that otherwise have power in digital spaces? I do think there was an interesting case presented by just the proliferation of, you know, Pegasus and NSO Group software in general, now the Predator files more recently. And it's interesting to see that as soon as people who are, you know, in close proximity to cabinets and to heads of states are attacked, people are very fast at rushing towards wanting to regulate that stuff, right? It's we need moratorias left, right, and center now, because our heads of states are being compromised, and this has huge national security implications, and states love national security implications. So you know, I will say, as soon as these things are turned inwards, they seem to have some form of reverberating effect towards reeling them in. The other spaces in which we've seen the same developments have been, for example, in the use of satellite imagery towards looking inwards at atrocity crimes that have been committed by various states, or looking inwards towards the security infrastructure that's being used towards policing particular community. As soon as you start doing that, both the tech company and the state goes, oh, we can't have that. That's too much power in the hands of individuals. But up until that point, it's fine, and we're developing it, and we're making it more high resolution, so high resolution that you could look, you know, at one pixel and find down to like 3 centimeters of accuracy, right? So it all comes down to who are you turning the gaze of surveillance towards. But if you start inverting the gaze of surveillance towards the state, towards the tech companies, you start seeing something different. That's not to say these things are all powerful, and I want to come back to Aino's point about sort of like all of these things to some extent can be seen as snake oil. And I do think that is accurate. One sort of anecdote to just share on that front is how, you know, there's a company, I won't mention any names, that develops facial recognition software, and they're, you know, a multi-million dollar company. And one of their, you know, sort of key selling points is that they're able to do gender detection. And you go to their expos and you test out the thing, and it clearly doesn't work, because the idea that you could even detect gender, you know, as a human, let alone as a computer, is sort of a bunch of farcical nonsense. But it's fascinating to see how the proxies that they use for gender are height of human beings and hair length. and if you ask them, well, you know, this is height and hair length, this isn't gender, like, no, we know, but in 5 years though. In 5 years, we'll be there. And I think that's sort of how the economy of a lot of the snake oil functions, right? It's on the premise of what's going to work in 5 to 10 years. It doesn't work that way now, which gives us space to resist, and which gives us space to like undo some of the patchwork, you know, claims towards having greater authority than these systems actually do. Some of them, of course, are more powerful than others, but yes, there is the possibility of resistance there. I'll stop there. There's much more to say.
I'll take a few more questions from the floor. Right, lots of hands going up. You had your hand up for a long time. They were in the green top, and then you at the front, and then there's two over here.
Hi, good evening, everyone. Thanks for a very interesting.
Feel free to introduce yourself if you want, but no obligation.
I work as an urban planning consultant, and I've been involved occasionally on a lot of digital cities and smart city projects for the public sector. And I think, you know, I want to acknowledge that there's a lot of buzz around making existing but also new cities smarter, digital, more connected. And the panel made a reference to some of the giga projects in Saudi Arabia as well. And most of these are done with the ambition to make it more connected, but more importantly, create synergies between existing city systems. But we all know that much of the decisions are taken based on who is funding and sponsoring city infrastructures and making it more smart, and more importantly, who's controlling but also sort of collecting data. As we know, data has maximum value more than anything in today's economy. But in spite of all of this, local governments, city governments, they're all commissioning work to, you know, make cities smarter. And so what do you think is their role? How can they make a shift and, you know, take a more human approach to synergizing city systems using digital technology, acknowledging that they're more often than not, they're striped with resources and capacity?
Thank you. And at the front here. And then there's two over here. Afterwards, there's two over here.
Thank you very much. It's been a super inspiring conversation and book. My name is Marta Granda, and I lead a team in Arup focusing on digital transformation and human-centered design. So very spot on to the topic. My question is about something that I see latent in the conversation but hasn't surfaced yet, which is about business models. And it's a reflection, I mean, it's really asking your thoughts around, is there an effective pathway towards reconciling the very narrow traditional business models of the digital industries. So they reconcile to the more richer economic models we see in cities, where we often talk about value, not only profit, and when we talk about sustainability, the triple balance, not just, you know, a direct cost benefit analysis. So there are two clashing forces here, which is not only about how we use the technologies, but how they were conceived originally. Sure. And is there any thoughts about how to get there?
Okay, those two questions are sort of a bit similar. They're both about our local governments, I think. And two more. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Shahir. I'm a student in the Media Communications Department. First of all, thank you to all the panelists, and congratulations to Professor Mehra for your book. My question is about, in our attempt to redesign the city to be more humanistic and safe and healthy for human beings and our society, what role does universal housing play in that, and how are we challenging homelessness? Is there a digital market solution to this? Is it a state solution? Is it more digital commons or something like that? Can there be a digital solution to it at all?
Yeah. Okay. And last question of the day, apart from what I'm going to ask.
Thank you. First of all, congratulations, Professor, and thank you to the entire panel. I'm Harshit Manchkani. I'm also a student at the Media Communications Department here at the LSE. As I see cities, digital cities for that matter, there are two levels that I can see. One is platform on which the digital aspect of the city is created, and then the infrastructure on which the city in itself, the physical street, the city is constructed. You think as we move towards this trend of having more digital cities in Global South and Global North, the infrastructure aspect of the cities would become more equitable, or would we start having the same 99% and 1% dichotomy in the digital cities as well?
Okay. Thank you very much. Right, we've got to end. We've got a few minutes left. I'm not going to give up on my hopefulness. So I've got a question for each of you. Is there any city which you think is doing something really progressive and hopeful and inspiring in this space? So we've got four questions from the floor, and I'm just going to add that one. Just don't take more than two in your response, and you don't have to answer mine.
I have actually. I can't remember, but just like remind me, there is a city in US like which banned the use of facial recognition technology for public sector and governmental sector. I think this is ideal city for me.
I'm gonna have you last, Maria. Okay.
For a hot moment, Barcelona was up there, not least because of Mayor Ada Colau, who, to answer the question around universal housing, was herself an anarchist housing activist and came to power at a moment in which the conversation around tech and tech corporations' role in the city has sort of, you know, exploded into, oh yes, absolutely. And she was the first mayor, to my knowledge, to say, no, absolutely not. And what she did was sort of carve back and roll back the presence of companies, and instead said, actually, what we need is data sovereign control by citizens over their own data, how it's shared with corporations, how it's shared towards potentially participatory projects around the city, and set up as a part of a larger EU consortium something, I think it was the Decidim project, unless I'm mistaken. And it was used in Barcelona basically to extend democratic power through the power and ownership of your own data. Now, there's a bigger discourse around whether true individual data ownership actually moves the needle of tech accountability and sort of critical, you know, usurping of those power dynamics. I don't think it really does, but I do think that Barcelona sort of had a initial run of trying to correct the course.
Ayala, do you want to respond to any of the questions?
I'm not sure there is a city as such, but there are some. Destin was going to be one of my examples too, and I teach it to my students as well. But I think also there are some digital platforms like Tocopticon, mm-hmm. where gig workers can actually evaluate their clients rather than the other way around, and so they can game the system, so to speak. Uber drivers also game the system to hike up fares. delivery drivers who go on strike. But maybe I can answer the first question around urban planning, because that's really my area as well. I think first and foremost, the city has a responsibility to its citizens, because they are using taxpayers' money. So whatever they do has to be for public good and not for the good of the corporates. I mean, that's the bottom line. And that's for any kind of infrastructure investment, which has never really adequately happened. So I don't think the digital is different in that way. It's just like before with big mega infrastructure projects, there was always forms of capitalism, capital interest that entered these infrastructure investments. So too now with digital infrastructure and technologies, capital interests have entered. So in that sense, it's not very different. But yes, what's different is that speed and scale and the how it's exploded really. And so I think just the basics of city elected councillors and mayors have a responsibility to their electorate in making the best use of funds. Like when we get research projects, we want to give value for money to our funders. So when the city gets its money from its citizens, it needs to give value for money to its citizens and not, you know, work for the needs of crony capitalism. That's what I would say. It's I think a basic need for the city to reorient in that way.
Miriam, last word to you.
Okay, I'm looking at the clock as well, so I'll try to do it in 1 minute. I think there's something in common in all these questions that perhaps seem in the first instance somehow unrelated. I think what I hear in all this question is that inquiry about urban justice. I think coming back to the questions of urban justice, and then how urban justice relates to these inequalities, huge inequalities that we see in cities. 1 in 50 Londoners is actually homeless or lives in temporary accommodation. Is that different to our demands about the accountability of the big tech or the surveillance system that that the local governments are involved in? So I think there's something about justice, inequality, and questions of accountability. And I think that point of accountability comes back to your question about where is hope and where is the ideal city. I think we can see fragments of ideal or positive elements in specific cities, but I think most importantly, what we see is movements of hope. You mentioned Barcelona, the municipalist movement that came out and was initiated by Barcelona, but it has become much bigger, I think is a source of hope. The same municipalist movement that looks for democratizing housing has also put together something that is called Cities for Digital Justice. And of course, we want it to do more than it does, but this is part of the agenda, how we actually need to address those questions and to be driven by the question of democratization of the city, the right to the city, and the right of the digital city being part of these much bigger questions. I think that's what Brilliant. I'm hoping that has come across in the book.
Brilliant. Great. Thank you all for coming. Just to remind you again that you can buy the book as you go out, or I think you could
walk. Drink.
Have a drink. There's a reception. Have
also
a drink.
Oh,
there's some flowers.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.